This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, many people were shocked last year when Robert Champion Jr., the drum major of a legendary Florida College marching band, died after what was described as a hazing incident. Hazing is not something most people associated with a marching band experience. Now, a large group of his fellow bandmates are facing serious consequences. We'll find out more in a few minutes. But first, we want to go from the sidelines to the football field itself. Even though football season is still months away, the NFL was very much in the headlines yesterday. First, the league announced that it is suspending four players without pay for their role in the New Orleans Saints bounty scandal. That's where players were apparently paid for hard hits on opponents. And then just hours later came news about the apparent death by suicide of Junior Seau. He'd played most of his career for his hometown San Diego Chargers. He was picked to play in 12 Pro Bowls. That's the NFL All-Star game. In addition to his on-field exploit, Seau was also famous for his constant smile, outgoing personality, and extensive community service work with children. And now some are raising questions again about whether brain injury may have played a role in his tragic death. We wanted to talk about all of this, so we've called upon two of our regular sports analysts. Pablo Torre is a writer for Sports Illustrated. Dave Zirin is the sports editor at The Nation magazine, and they're both regular guests in our Barbershop Roundtable, which is on most Fridays. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Pablo, let me just start with you. What are your memories about Junior Seau, and what went through your mind when you heard about his death?
I was shocked. I mean, we've seen guys, Dave Duris and Ray Easterling, very recently in the last 15 months commit suicide. But Junior Seau is by far the biggest name, I think, to the casual fan. A superstar, full stop, an elite linebacker, a guy who was the Michael Jordan of American Samoa in some ways. Samoa has produced so many NFL players. He was the guy everybody looked up to. And he was a guy who was pretty much equally beloved in the United States, a guy whose kindness has been remembered in recent hours by pretty much everybody who ever came in contact with him.
Dave Zirin, what about you? What crossed your mind?
Well, obviously, shock was the first emotion to cross my mind. I had met Mr. Seau once, and he had a kind of charismatic gravitational pull that you only find very seldomly, I think, in life. And my first thought, though, was about 2 years ago, a story about Junior Seau driving his car off of a bridge after – off of a cliff, I'm sorry, after being investigated for a domestic violence complaint by his live-in girlfriend at the time. And I thought about that story and remembered that the police took Seau at his word, that he was just asleep at the wheel and it was just a horrible accident and he was fine. And thinking at the time, wow, if there was ever a city that would give Junior Seau a pass, it would be San Diego. And sometimes giving somebody a pass is the most dangerous thing you can do for them.
But you were also telling us earlier, and we've been talking a lot on this program about the whole question of brain injury and the possible connection to suicide. And, you know, obviously we don't know all the details. You know, we don't know whether perhaps any note was left or whether there have been sort of private medical issues that have not yet come to the surface. But the elephant in the room, as Pablo just talked about, was the fact that there have been a number of suicides of NFL players recently. Ray Easterling, who played for the Atlanta Falcons, took his own life a few weeks ago. Last year, Dave Duerson left a suicide note asking examiners to study his brain, and they found extensive signs of damage related to blows to the head. And so, Dave, I just have to ask, whether is that being discussed here? I know the advocates around brain injury issues in the NFL have been talking about this online. I've seen a lot of discussion online. What are some of the reasons why they're talking about this?
Oh, well, one of the reasons why they're discussing it so much is the manner in which Junior Seau took his own life, which was a gunshot to the chest, which is in the exact manner in which Dave Duerson took his own life, very explicitly by Dave Duerson, because he said he wanted his brain to be able to be studied. So to have Seau kill himself in the same manner was something that people immediately raised questions about, like, was he having issues with brain injuries?
And is there a record of concussion? Did he have a record of brain injury that we know about?
This is what was so shocking to me as I was looking into it. Junior Seau played for 2 decades in the National Football League, was known for his ferocious hits. There is not one public note of him being diagnosed with a concussion in all that time. And you see that, you can only draw one of two conclusions. Either Junior Seau was somehow made of magic to be able to go 20 years without getting a concussion in the National Football League, or it just was not reported when it happened, which meant it wasn't treated. Now, whether that happened because of Junior Seau not wanting it to get out or whether it was team doctors, whatever it is, it speaks to the kind of neglect towards the issue of head injuries that's existed in the NFL until recently for all too long.
Pablo, before we turn the page and talk about the other big NFL news today, I wanted to ask whether you see any signs of a cultural shift, perhaps among players, because as Dave indicated, that there's a two-way street here. There are perhaps owners, managers, doctors mm-hmm. who might be invested in not being as aggressive about this, but there are also players who don't want to be taken out of the game. Are you seeing any signs that players themselves are thinking more about this?
Yes. I think the only, there's no better warning than to see a peer, a guy who seems so invulnerable, kill himself. I mean, that's really the only way to get through to an NFL player, I think, to cut past all of the other issues here, the machismo, the stigma of all of that. And I also note, on top of what Dave was saying, was that there's also the other elephant in the room, which is just mental illness. The Venn diagram of mental illness and head trauma, they aren't completely overlapping all the time. We don't know yet what the cause was, but in either situation, whether it was just, quote unquote, just mental illness or CTE, this brain trauma, either way, those are two endemic problems in sports that really need to be addressed.
I'm speaking with sports journalist Pablo Torre, that's who was speaking just now, and Dave Zirin. We're talking about the death of NFL great Junior Seau, apparently at his own hand. We also want to talk about the big suspensions handed out yesterday in the New Orleans Saints bounty case. Dave, you had a final thought
about this? Just a major shift I've seen even in the last 5 years is when I ask NFL players, would you want your son playing this game?
Right.
They all pause now, and many of them say no. That's very different.
Well, so turning the page, even though it really is kind of a related story, the NFL has been handing out big penalties to the New Orleans Saints for the so-called bounty scandal. That's where players were paid bonuses for things like hard hits or even knocking other players out of games. So, Dave, tell us about the latest developments and how are these being viewed within the league?
Suspensions have been handed down to four players who were on that New Orleans Saints team, even though 27 apparently were implicated. Only two of those players still play for the Saints at this time, Will Smith and Jonathan Vilma, who had the stiffest penalty. He's out for the entire season. And Scott Fujita, who has been a very outspoken player on the issue of player safety, has been suspended for 3 games for the Cleveland Browns, as well as a player named Anthony Hargrove, who plays for the Green Bay Packers. Now, it's being viewed like with a lot of shock around the NFL.
And by whom? You mean
by players and the media.
The media.
For two reasons is the big shock. The first is that by all accounts, the players heard about it on ESPN SportsCenter. They weren't informed by the league that they were suspended, and that was seen as quite the slap to the face. And the second thing that really just absolutely floored people was that, according to all accounts, the players never got to see the evidence that had been accumulated against them, and they've all said they're going to appeal, but the appeal is to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell.
The same person who made the decision. Dave, I know you have an opinion about this. I'm going to go to Pablo first, and then I'll give you a minute to give your opinion about this. Pablo, what's your take on this? Do you think that those are fair? What are you hearing?
I mean, I don't think – well, I guess on the topic of evidence, that's something that I don't know if it could ever be resolved. I mean, I don't think players were receiving receipts. They weren't itemizing bounty payouts on their tax returns. So I don't know if that could ever be produced, which is just adding to the problem. But whether it's fair or not, I think the larger conclusion is that it's in line with what Roger Goodell is trying to do, which is deter this behavior from ever happening again. And I think in that frame of mind – he has no problem suspending Jonathan Vilma for an entire year or Scott Fujita. He's going after guys who are outspoken, who are leaders. That was his stated justification. He wants to target, in an ironic way to use one of Greg Williams, the disgraced defensive coordinator of the Saints, one of his phrases, he's going after the head. He's going after guys who are faces and names and people who are most prominent in an effort to make sure that a bounty program, targeted injuries just don't happen ever again. Now, whether that can happen is another question.
Dave Zirin, I know you have an opinion about this, and you've been very skeptical about this, I guess, putting the onus on players.
Strongly skeptical. I'm skeptical of it for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first is that by many, many accounts, this occurs in a lot of locker rooms around the NFL and has mm-hmm. been a part of the NFL culture for more than a few decades. And coming down this hard on one particular team, the New Orleans Saints, and the players in particular, to me, feels like an effort by Roger Goodell to much more send a message to fans, send a message to people who see the NFL as family-friendly entertainment, and send a message to the legal and judicial community, because right now more than 1,000 former NFL players are suing the NFL because of issues that deal with withholding knowledge about the effects of head injuries. And to me, it's not an honest way to go about the issue, because head injuries in the NFL happen because the sport is football, not because of bounties.
So is there any way to make it safer? Is there any way to – I'm guessing what would be the Dave Zirin approach here if you don't agree with Roger Goodell's?
Well,
briefly, if you would.
I think the right approach has to be a full knowledge and full discussion about what are the effects of actually playing in the National Football League, because that's what we don't have right now. I think Roger Goodell should settle with the players who are suing the league, get that off the table right away instead of fight it to the degree to which that they are fighting it, and that they need to start to address the issue about, okay, what are the real ramifications of playing in the National Football League, so parents with kids and so players can make informed decisions about when they play. Because, I mean, I've just talked to too many retired players who say, if I knew now what I knew then, and that's what I think we want to eliminate.
Yeah, ironically, still the most popular sport in
the NFL
America.
Doesn't want to know. They don't want to know the answer to that. I mean, that's
I was asked for the Dave Zirin way. Okay.
Well, to be continued, Pablo Torre is a writer for Sports Illustrated. He was with us from our bureau in New York City. Dave Zirin is the sports editor for The Nation. He was with us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let's turn to the economic crisis in Europe. The European Central Bank's governing board met yesterday in Spain, which has the Eurozone's highest unemployment rate. The board members were greeted with jeers from protesters. After months of punishing austerity measures, some Spaniards want a break, perhaps in the form of some economic stimulus from Europe. They didn't get good news from the central bank, as Lauren Freyer reports.
Even the location of the European Central Bank summit here in Barcelona was kept a secret, which tells you something about how officials thought they'd be received here. One in four Spaniards is jobless, and the rate is more than 50% for youth. If central bankers were to stroll the streets here, this is what they'd find. Thousands of demonstrators flooded streets, and so did 8,000 police, some in plain clothes and masks, with helicopters overhead. 18-year-old protester Angel Juan says he'd like a word with ECB president Mario Draghi.
Many people who are here, their parents haven't got job for many years. Maybe their neighbors aren't living in their house because the bank has taken them out. And I think maybe I will talk to him and I will tell them to stop this madness.
But the ECB offered no new help, keeping interest rates unchanged and saying it's the job of individual governments and not the ECB to boost growth and alleviate the pain of austerity. Draghi even applauded Spain.
I think it's now time to look with, a certain degree of accomplishment, but not complacency, to what has been done.
What has been done is what some here call draconian, $35 billion slashed from the budget in a single year. Health and education fees are up, and labor reform makes it easier for companies to fire workers. So unemployment has risen too. Draghi said such structural reforms are necessary for eventual growth. But some Spaniards fear the medicine may be killing the patient. The problem is there may be no other option, says economist Pedro Videla at IESE Business School.
People are suffering, but the issue is, okay, we don't want more recession. What should we do? Can we spend more money? No, we don't have money.
Calls are mounting across Europe for more growth and fewer budget cuts. This weekend, France may elect a socialist president who wants to renegotiate the EU fiscal treaty to allow more spending in order to boost growth. But Vidala says that may not work everywhere. After all, overspending is what got us into this mess in the first place.
Everybody wants to grow. No government will want to say, I don't want growth. It's silly to think that the solution for countries like Spain is to spend more, because then the market will punish the bonds of Spain, increasing the spread, increasing the debt service, increasing the debt of Spain.
As it stands, there's no chance of growth here. Spain's economy is forecast to shrink this year, though the ECB forecasts a very slight recovery in Europe overall. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Barcelona.
Finally this hour, the sound of comic book superheroes smashing box office records.
How about that?
It all started last weekend when Marvel's The Avengers opened in 39 countries around the world, and it will likely continue when the film hits U.S. theaters tonight at midnight. Legions of fans have already bought advance tickets, and critic Bob Mondello suspects they'll be pleased.
War has started.
And we are hopelessly outgunned.
Oh, spare me. Our guys have a hammer, exploding arrows, a shield, broad shoulders. How are they going to be underdogs in this fight? I mean, sure, the bad guy, Loki, has an army of aliens ready to pounce, but as Iron Man tells him, the Avengers have a not-so-jolly green giant.
Let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod.
That'd be Thor.
A super soldier.
Captain America.
Living legend who kind of lives up to the legend.
Iron Man.
A man with breathtaking anger management issues.
Hulk.
A couple of master assassins, and you! Big fella, you've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
There's a problem, though. All of the folks that he just mentioned, including those world-class assassins, Hawkeye and Black Widow, don't really play well with others. So turning them into an actual team will take time. Time that director Joss Whedon fills with the kind of one-on-one superhero matchups fanboys can usually only dream about. Irresistible Hammer meets immovable Shield. Snarky billionaire taunts a guy who's trying to stay calm.
And I'm a huge fan of the way you lose control and turn into an enormous green rage monster.
And who'd win a fair fight? Thor? Iron Man? Hulk? Let's go find a mountaintop and break some trees. There is a plot. The Earth is at risk because our Tesseract went on the fritz and got stolen. Don't sweat the details. It's a cube and it's opening up wormholes for giant eel-like spaceships. Luckily, we've got a gizmo of our own, a nifty battleship that I guess you'd have to call a stealth helicarrier. Still, Whedon knows that mere gizmos do not a superhero movie make, so he's ordered up a lot of quips, some explosive laughs, actually. And so that you can still enjoy the picture if you're over 15, he's made sure that all of his stars get to shine in moments without digital effects. Considering what a 3D traffic jam the Avengers could have been with six heroes in spandex and big-name hangers-on from Samuel L. Jackson to Gwyneth Paltrow, it's impressive that the filmmaker still found time to do things like, say, let Mark Ruffalo be understated as the latest in a line of Hulks.
Doctor, we need you to come in.
What if I say no?
I'll persuade you.
All of this, of course, leading to a bone-crunching, skyscraper-shattering, giant eel-eviscerating showdown that lays waste to much of Manhattan, looks really cool, and sets up what will doubtless be Marvel superhero sequels too numerous to count.
You ready for another bout?
What, you getting sleepy?
Can't say The Avengers makes me look forward to seeing any of its heroes flying solo again, but it does establish that in smaller doses, even the most annoying type A personalities can be amusing. Of course, as a just-released trailer for the last third of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy reminds us, a caped crusader movie can aspire to greater things, but nobody says it has to, and Joss Whedon just wants The Avengers to be fun, which it is. I'm Bob Mundell.
Spring is the season when some college students are going to have to prove they can stay afloat. I'm talking here about a swimming test. It remains a graduation requirement on a handful of campuses, mostly in the Northeast. For seniors who've been putting off the swim test, now is the time to sink or swim, as NPR's Joel Rose reports.
It's a few days before final exams at Bryn Mawr College outside Philadelphia, but about half a dozen seniors gather nervously at the edge of the campus pool for a different kind of test. Bryn Mawr Aquatics Director Nikki Whitlock explains the rules.
The key to this is going slow. It does not matter how many laps you do, okay? It only matters that you're swimming for the 10 minutes continuously, all right?
That's 10 minutes of continuous swimming, followed by 1 minute each of floating and treading water. A century ago, lots of schools required students to pass a swim test. Now it's just a few holdouts that cling to the tradition, including Cornell, Columbia, MIT, and Swarthmore.
We had just been given our mandatory physicals and were told to go jump in the pool and swim. I jumped in the pool and sank.
Maurice Eldridge eventually passed the swim test at Swarthmore College. Now he's a vice president there. But even Eldridge isn't sure exactly when the school's test started or why.
There's a story that has floated around having to do with someone drowning and then some person of that family providing money with the stipulation that everybody have to swim, learn to swim. And I can't find any credible reason for believing that.
There actually was a Swarthmore student who drowned in 1912 whose relatives later donated money to build the campus swimming pool. But Eldridge says there's no record of any connection between those two events. Still, the rumors persist, and not just at Swarthmore.
Some people say some wealthy donor's student drowned or died on the Titanic or something.
Samuel Roth is a senior at Columbia University in Manhattan, which requires a swim test for students in certain academic programs but not others. Roth says there are lots of theories about why.
If the island were flooded, we'd need to know how to swim to get to New Jersey. But then, of course, the engineers don't have to do it. And they say, well, we could build a boat or a bridge to escape, which to me is totally ridiculous because you're not going to do that during flooding.
As swim tests go, Columbia's is pretty easy. Still, Roth waited until spring of his senior year to take it. Junior Will Hughes says that is not unusual.
It's this big thing, I feel, to take it like your senior spring and you do it with all your like senior friends. Especially like in April, like every time you see it, there's like hundreds of people that go there to do it together.
1 minute left, 1 minute.
Back at Bryn Mawr, aquatics director Nikki Whitlock would like to persuade her students not to wait until the last minute. The school is following the lead of Swarthmore, which tries to get students into the pool during freshman orientation. And for students who are really scared, Bryn Mawr offers a class to help them learn basic water safety. Senior Lila Zillis took it this spring.
Before I took the swim class, I couldn't even float. And now that I've learned to float, I can say, well, even though, you know, I'm still scared to fall into the deep end of the pool, I would know what to do.
Bryn Mawr coach Nikki Whitlock looks pleased with that. Whitlock says she's never had to prevent a student from graduating, and she doesn't want to start now. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Greenland's glaciers hold enough water to raise sea level by 20 feet. And as the planet warms, they are melting. But it's been hard to figure out just how fast they're melting and how quickly sea level will rise. Well, a team of researchers has been trying to do just that. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, they've released a study that offers some reassuring news.
A few years ago, the Jakobshavn Glacier in Greenland really caught people's attention. In short order, this slow-moving stream of ice suddenly doubled its speed. It started dumping a whole lot more ice into the Atlantic. Other glaciers also sped up. For glacier scientists like Ian Jockin at the University of Washington, the question was whether this was start of a rapid meltdown of Greenland glaciers.
Some people feared that if they could double their speed over 2 or 3 years, they could keep doubling and doubling and doubling and reach very fast speeds.
If the world's big glaciers were on their way to a tenfold speed up, that could lead to a staggering 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. So Jockin and colleagues have been trying to see if that's started. They pored over radar images of 200 Greenland glaciers gathered over the past decade. Graduate student Twyla Moon says some of Greenland's glaciers picked up the pace and started surging forward more than 5 miles in a year.
Turns out that glacial pace isn't very slow.
It also turns out that glacial pace isn't consistent. The glaciers like Jakobshavn that started surging haven't kept on picking up speed. In fact, some have slowed down. And glacier speeds vary dramatically. Picture streams of ice that start out as one giant river and then split into two on their way toward the sea.
We saw cases where one of those might be consistently speeding up, while the one right next to it might speed up one year, slow down the next, speed up again.
When they added up what all those glaciers were doing during the last decade, they see a 30% increase in speed overall.
We're still seeing velocities increase, so we can expect continued sea level rise from the Greenland ice sheet.
But their report in Science magazine says they aren't seeing the runaway meltdown of Greenland that some had feared. That makes sense to Ian Jockin, given the lay of the land.
All of the ice flows towards the coast and squeezes through these narrow outlet glaciers, much like toothpaste kind of squeezing out of the nozzle of a toothpaste tube.
That imposes a natural limit on how much ice can flow off the bedrock. But those bottlenecks don't exist in Antarctica, where other glaciers are also surging toward the sea. So that's still an important wild card. But given what's happening in Greenland, Jockin says the worst-case scenario for 6 feet of sea level rise this century is looking very unlikely. His worst case?
My guess, and it is a guess, is probably a meter or less, 3 feet or less.
Jockin isn't breathing a sigh of relief, though. 3 feet of sea level rise would still threaten millions of people around the world who live near sea level. And Josh Willis from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena says sea levels won't magically stop rising at the end of the century under any scenario.
So we're going to see a lot more sea level rise. The question is, how fast is it going to come, and are we going to be able to adapt in time?
Willis says the problem is, how do you plan if you don't know whether sea level will rise 1 foot this century, which is the low-end estimate, or 6 feet?
The difference between 1 foot and 6 feet is really enormous in terms of cost and adaptation and mitigation measures.
Narrowing that uncertainty requires gathering more observations from satellites. But that's a problem. Those eyes in the sky are going blind. The National Research Council notes with alarm that Earth-observing satellites are wearing out much faster than they're being replaced. With budget troubles, the U.S. could lose most of its Earth-observing capacity in just 8 years. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Time now for StoryCorps, the project that's putting your stories on tape for future generations. When Ricardo Zavala recorded his interview in Austin, Texas, he remembered his grandfather, Vicente Domingo Villa, and a story that began in the mid-1920s.
When he was growing up, he was living in South Texas on ranches, and his father was a ranch hand, as his father before him was a ranch hand, and his father before him was a ranch hand. And when he was about 6 or 7, he did ask his mom if he could have cowboy chaps, just like the cowboys wore on the ranch. He didn't think he had much of a chance at getting it, but Christmas Day, his mom presented him with a pair of chivarras. Chivarras are chaps, but instead of cowhide, they're made out of goat skin. It's a smaller animal, so they fit children a lot better. And he said he was so excited, he was so happy. That was the best gift he'd ever gotten. The only problem was that his father got very upset with his mom for having wasted the money on a pair of chivarras for a boy who doesn't even do cowboy work, and it caused a lot of fighting. So he decided he would ask his mom to return the chivarras, but he figured he could at least sleep with them that night, and that's what he did. Well, towards the end of his life, he was at a nursing home, and we ended up getting him real cowhide chaps, but he kind of got upset with us. He said it was a waste of money. So I told him that I actually had a favor to ask of him. I told him, I'd really like for you to consider, once you do pass, having the chaps buried with you. And that way, when I get to heaven, I'll be able to recognize you. And then he looked down and he said, you know, I don't know if that's where I'm going. A few months later, he got real sick, and he was dying. We were at his deathbed, and I was standing next to him, and he said to me, entiérreme con mis chivarras, bury me with my chaps. And that brought a lot of comfort, because later on that night, he did pass. It was May 5th of 2003. And I knew that he knew where he was going.
Ricardo Isaías Zavala, remembering his grandfather, Vicente Domingo Villa. Ricardo spoke with his son, Ricardo Javier Zavala, at StoryCorps in Austin, Texas, and their interview will be archived at the Library of Congress. The StoryCorps podcast is at npr.org.